Live from the Public Radio Conference in Washington, D.C., I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and Otis Redding were Arthur Alexander's fans, and they recorded his songs on their early albums. On today's Fresh Air, a live concert with soul singer and songwriter Arthur Alexander. He's just made his first album in 20 years. The album was produced by guitarist Ben Vaughan, who's leading the band today. Also today, a guest who doesn't sing, but without him, some of the best soul music of the 60s would never have been recorded. We'll talk with Jerry Wexler. During his years at Atlantic Records, he produced classic recordings by the Drifters, Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, and Otis Redding. That's all coming up live on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Ham Radio reports from eastern Bosnia say that Bosnian Serb troops are continuing their attack on the besieged Muslim town of Zepa, despite its designation as a UN-protected area. Zepa was one of six Bosnian towns named as safe zones in a Security Council resolution issued last night. The Bosnian Serb vice president said earlier today that his side would respect the safe havens, but UN Commander Philippe Morillon was denied access to Zepa again today. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has returned to Washington after talks with Italian leaders in Rome. Their discussion centered on more measures against Bosnian Serbs now that the self-styled Bosnian Serb parliament has rejected an international peace plan. Francis Kennedy reports.
Rome was the last stop on Mr. Christopher's European tour aimed at winning support for stronger measures against the Bosnian Serbs. After his talks with Prime Minister Ciampi and the defense and foreign ministers, Mr. Christopher said the main aim was to reinforce pressure on Serbia. He said that limited action in Yugoslavia could be undertaken under the present United Nations resolution, but an explicit authorization by the UN was more likely. For his part, Mr. Ciampi emphasized the need for full solidarity in any initiative, saying the backing of Russia was essential. The Italian Defense Minister, Mr. Andriata, said that Italy was prepared to take risks. As a neighboring country, it is not allowed to intervene, but it has put its military bases at the disposal of the NATO troops enforcing the no-fly zone. For National Public Radio, I'm Frances Kennedy in Rome.
Members of the U.S. Senate came forward today to express their views on the ban against homosexuals in the military. NPR's John Greenberg has more.
The Senate Armed Services Committee has been hearing testimony from outside experts since late March on gays in the military. Today it was the insiders' turn. Alaska Republican Frank Murkowski warned that homosexuals in uniform would increase the cost of treating AIDS for the Veterans Administration.
I believe allowing gays to openly serve in the armed forces would have an adverse effect on the 27 million American veterans that the VA system serves.
Massachusetts Democrat John Kerry argued that the ban should be overturned.
A country that can defeat Hitler is a country that can deal with people, whether it's a question of holding hands on a base or otherwise.
Next Monday, the committee goes to Norfolk, Virginia to hear the views of men and women in uniform. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 5 points to close at 3,437. The NASDAQ Composite Index fell 3.2 points to 680. Advances edged declines in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Senate Republicans are stalling another part of President Clinton's legislative program by refusing to end debate on the issue. The latest Republican filibuster is directed at the so-called Motor Voter Bill, which would make it easier to register to vote. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell accused the Republicans of what he called an unprecedented partisan use of filibusters to thwart the will of the people. Republican leader Bob Dole countered that the filibuster is the only way for the GOP to stop legislation or bring about change. The Senate will vote on a motion to cut off the Motor Voter filibuster on Tuesday. A judge in Montgomery, Alabama, has suspended a 5-year prison term for former Governor Guy Hunt, but ordered him to perform 1,000 hours of community service following his conviction on federal ethics violations. Alan Collins of member station WUAL reports.
the former governor has been ordered to find jobs for inmates on probation in his home county of Cullman. Hunt was convicted of diverting $200,000 from a nonprofit fund into his personal bank account. Hunt, though, is confident of overturning the conviction.
We still feel like that we do not know of any particular law that we have violated, and we have filed notice of appeal. We believe, have reason to believe, that appeal will be successful.
Hunt has also been fined $10,000 and ordered to repay the state the $200,000 he was accused of misappropriating. Hunt won't begin the sentence, though, pending an appeal of the case. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Collins in Montgomery.
In Somalia today, a Belgian soldier was wounded in fighting with Somali gunmen outside the southern port of Kismayu. The soldier was part of a UN peacekeeping unit that has taken over from American troops. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You're about to discover or rediscover a very soulful singer and songwriter, Arthur Alexander. His early records inspired the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. As Keith Richards said, when the Beatles and the Stones got their first chance to record, the Beatles did Alexander's song Anna, and the Stones did his song You Better Move On. That should tell you enough. Alexander had rhythm and blues hits in the 60s and 70s. He's recently been coaxed back onto the music scene after an absence of close to two decades. After he gave up music, he moved from his home in Alabama to Cleveland, where he's been driving a bus for a community center. The good news is he's just recorded his first album in 20 years for the Elektra American Explorer series. And we couldn't be happier about presenting one of the first concerts in this new stage of his career. Our band is led by the producer of the new album, guitarist Ben Vaughan. We're broadcasting live from the annual Public Radio Conference in Washington, D.C., with a studio audience of our colleagues from around the country. Let's get started with a song, and I'll let Arthur Alexander introduce it.
Okay, this is a song that I did years ago, and I also had the pleasure of doing on my new Elektra album, a little thing that goes a little something like this. It's entitled, Go Home Girl. Well, now me and Frank, we're the best of friends, and our friendship will never end. But it would hurt him so for him to know that I love his girlfriend. Now the love of a girl and the love of a friend are two things you can't compare. So my heart will ache, but I will let it break, 'cause I know it just ain't fair. Go on home, girl, let's call it a night. Go on home, girl, this just ain't right. But before you go, I want you to know that I love you, yes I do. Though it may break my heart, but darling, we must part, 'cause I know Frank loves you too. That's really real, but I think that he is just like me, and I don't know just how he'd feel. But darling, I do know it would hurt him so if you told him that it must end. And I could never hold a love I stole from a man I call my best friend. Go on home, girl, let's call it a night. Go on home, girl, this just ain't right. Go on home, girl,
go on home, baby. Please, you know I love you, but he does too, and you belong to him. Yes, you do. Go on home, baby. Please, you better go right now.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
It's really so great to have Arthur Alexander performing again, and I really want to know what it's been like for you, what it's like for you to perform now, to perform again.
It feels great. It feels great. You know, it brings back old memories. You know, I always did love performing, by the way. You know, I didn't leave because... I didn't like performing. I left because of other reasons, you know.
What kind of reasons?
Well, record people, publishers, you know. When you make a hit record, you kind of like to get paid, you know.
Well, you actually had a lot of your copyrights that you sold to or gave to other people, so you didn't even make a lot of money from some of your songs that other people did?
Well, I signed publishing over to publishers. But in turn, they were supposed to pay me, you know. You see, I didn't have a publishing company right. when I got into the business, you know. So other people published the songs, and they were supposed to pay me, you know. The way it's supposed to go is the writer gets half from the publisher.
Right.
That half I never saw.
So my impression is that you had to be kind of coaxed to come back and perform. It's not like you were really looking to do it. So did they have to really talk you into it? I know first you were asked to do an Alabama Music Hall of Fame thing, and then you were asked to do a record. Did they have to talk you into it?
Yeah, they did pretty much, because I had resigned myself to doing what I was doing, and I was happy doing that, you know. And they opened this Hall of Fame thing in Alabama, and Rick Hall called me and said that they had reserved a spot down there, and they had a star in it for me, and would I come down and sing a few numbers. And after a while, I agreed to do that. And after I'd done that, they called me back the next year for the Helen Keller Festival and asked me if I would come down and sing a few numbers for that. And I agreed to that. And I met Donnie Fritz there, and he was telling me about a thing in New York at the Bottom Line called a bunch of songwriters sitting around singing. And would I come and do that? And I was a little reluctant about that because I thought New York was a stretch, you know. And he said he had did it, you know, and he asked if it was okay if he gave Alan Pepper, the owner, my number. And I said okay.
And that's how it all started.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah. So I want you to do another song. Time goes so quickly when you're live. But I just want to, we have a great band, and I want to introduce them before we do the next song. We have Ben Vaughn on guitar, Bobby J lead guitar, Seth Baer on drums, and Mike Vogelman on bass. And you want to do another song?
Sure.
Yeah, great band, great band.
This is from my Elektra album, Genie in the Jar. Little genie in the jar, I got bitten by your bug. You drove away my true love, and she ain't never coming back to me. And she ain't never coming back to me. But she left you on the table to comfort me and keep me stable. You try to help, but you ain't able. Cause she ain't never coming back to me. She ain't never coming back to me. Little genie in the jug, I got bitten by your bug. You drove away my true love,
And she ain't never coming back to me. She ain't never coming back to me. All right. In the jug, we might as well just board a bus, cause she ain't never coming back to us. Or she ain't never coming back to us. She ain't never coming back to me. Or she ain't never coming back to me. She ain't never coming back to me. Or she ain't never coming back to me.
Take a short break, and then we'll be back with more of this concert with Arthur Alexander. And I want to remind you before we break that he's got a new record and does some of these songs on them. The album's called Lonely Just Like Me. This is Fresh Air. Back live with a concert featuring Arthur Alexander. Arthur, the next song you're going to do is one a lot of our listeners will know. You Better Move On. The Rolling Stones recorded it early in their career. Do you know how the Rolling Stones and Beatles got to know your songs and record them?
Well, the story I got, you know, there's a radio station called Radio Luxembourg. And that station was piped into London, you know, I think. And they all listened to that station. And on that station, they played like a lot of R&B. And my tune was among them. And I think that's how they heard me.
Want to do it for us?
Sure.
You asked me to give up the hand of the girl I love. You tell me I'm not the man she's worthy of. But who are you to tell her who to love? That's up to her. Yes, and the Lord above. You better move on. Well, I know you can buy her fancy clothes and diamond rings, but I believe she's happy with me without those things. Still, you beg me to set her free, but my friend, that will never be. Better move on. I can't blame you for loving her, but can't you understand, man, she's my girl. And I'm never gonna let her go. Oh no. Cause I love her so. And I think you better go. Now I'm getting mighty mad. You asked me to give up the only love I've ever had. Maybe I would. Oh, but I love her so. I'm never gonna let her go. You better move on.
better move on. Better move on.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Arthur, you have such a really Southern-based sound. I know you're from Alabama. You sang in the church when you were young?
Yeah. Matter of fact, I started in the church. You know, my father, he was a old blues player, you know. But when I came along, I got to be about 5 or 6, you know, he stopped because, like me, he never made no money, you know. And he didn't want me to take that path, you know. So I shot him a curve. You know, I started singing with a group called the Hard Strings in the church. And he loved that, you know, because he found religion later in life. Matter of fact, I saw him get baptized, you know. And he was an avid churchgoer after that. And he thought I was on the right path.
What kind of music were you doing in the church?
Religious music, you know.
Well, I mean, was it tight harmonies or what?
I'm working on the building and, you know, songs like that, you know. Old Negro religious spirituals, you know. Things with a lot of heart to them, you know.
And when you started performing in Alabama in the early 60s, very segregated, and you toured in, like, rhythm and blues shows where the acts were integrated but the audiences weren't.
Right. When I first started in the early 60s, you played two shows. You played one to a white audience, and you played another one to the black audience. And in 63, I think it was me, Chubby Checker, D.D. Clark, the Four Seasons, and another group, I can't recall their names now. But in Jackson, Tennessee, all that came to a halt because they had it lined up for the two shows. But when they ushered the white audience in, the black audience came in too, and there was a riot. And hey, they turned over the bus, they tore up the bus, and they started throwing rocks and stones and bottles, and I was lucky to get out of there.
Wow. I want to get in another song before we run out of time. And this is a song that I think a lot of our listeners will recognize. It's Every Day I Had to Cry. Now, you had a hit of this in the 70s, and then Steve Alamo recorded it in the 60s and had a hit with that.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Yeah, so, and this is, of course, on your new album, too.
Yes.
And you want to do it?
Sure.
There was a little girl I had planned to marry. This was my love. I didn't want to share it. I thought that love would make my life bright and sunny. She said she couldn't love me cause I didn't have no money. So every day I have to cry, son. Every day I have to cry, son. Dry the water from my eyes, son. Every day I have to cry. I had me a girl, and yes, I really loved her every night. Well, I was thinking of her, but you can't mix love with money. Cause if you do, you're gonna hurt somebody. And every day I have to cry some. Every day I have to cry some. Dry the water from my eyes some. Every day I have to cry. Lord, I know that I'm just a poor man, but is it wrong to love cause I'm not a rich man? But you can't mix love with money, cause when you do, you're gonna hurt somebody. And every day I have to cry some. Every day I have to cry some. Dry the water from my eyes, son. Every day I have to cry. Every day I have to cry, son. Every day I have to cry, son.
travel water from my eyes, son. Every day I have to cry. Every day I have to let the water fall from my eyes. Every day I have to let the water fall from my eyes. Every day I have to ooh, cry some. Every day I have to cry some. Travel water from my eyes some. Every day I have to cry.
Thank you.
I feel like we're all really privileged to have you back singing and recording and, you know, doing concerts again. What do you want to be different this time around?
Well, number one, I want to get paid.
You don't mean that personally, right? I mean, that's not.
No, I mean, you know, from my work, my records, my, you know, my songs and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
And well, this time it'll be different because I have, you know, most of my publishing right backs and back and on the new songs that I've written, you know, I have the publishing on those. So hopefully, you know, the money will come direct to me and there won't be no middleman and everything will work smoothly.
You've been driving a bus for a community center in Cleveland where you live now. How much do the people who you work with know about who you are as a singer and songwriter? How much do they know about that music part of your life, the part that you're going back to now?
Well, they know everything now since the record has come out, you know, and everything. But for a while there, they didn't. You know, I kept it sort of like undercover because when I did bring it up, you know, they look at me and say, yeah, sure, you know. So, you know, I just let it lay, you know.
So, do you think you'll be doing concerts over the summer? You have things coming up?
Yeah, I think Elektra is lining up some stuff. I hear tell that, you know, they got a thing now called the Party in the Park. It's going to be
A Central Park concert?
Yeah. And I think that's already set, and I'm looking forward to that.
Well, I just have one thing to say before you go, and that is the concert was extraordinary. There's one disappointment, and that is I didn't get nearly enough time to talk with you. So I'm going to have to insist that when you have time, you come back and visit with us on Fresh Air so that we could just talk and have a long interview, because I'm anxious to hear so much more about your life. Will you do that?
I sure will.
Oh, great. I want to thank Arthur Alexander. And I want to mention again, his new album is called Lonely Just Like Me. It's on the Elektra Nonesuch American Explorer series. The album's produced by Ben Vaughn, who's leading our band today. Ben Vaughn on guitar, Bobby J lead guitar, Seth Baer drums, Mike Vogelman bass. I'm Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air. Thank you all for being here. And Ben's going to play us out with some more music that you'll recognize from Arthur Alexander.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Live from the Public Radio Conference in Washington, D.C., I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. He coined the term rhythm and blues, and he went on to produce classic recordings by Ray Charles, The Drifters, Otis Redding, Wilson Pickett, and Aretha Franklin. Coming up, we'll be joined live by Jerry Wexler. Our house band is led by Ben Vaughn, and they're paying tribute to the King Curtis version of Ode to Billy Joe, produced, of course, by Jerry Wexler. Stay with us for this special Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton says in the next few days there will be a common approach presented by Western allies on steps to end the fighting in the former Yugoslavia. Mr. Clinton said his final decision on a new course against Bosnian Serbs will not be made until Secretary of State Warren Christopher reports on his talks with allies in Europe, who have indicated less than full support for military action. The president said that more consultation with Congress is also needed. Mr. Clinton said if he decides to order airstrikes against Serb targets in Bosnia, he will have a clearly defined plan, along with very clear aims. President Clinton unveiled his long-awaited campaign finance reform proposal today. If approved, it would end campaign contributions from lobbyists and put limits on the amount of money that political candidates can raise and spend. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton's plan would limit the total amount of money congressional candidates could spend. In order to induce candidates to accept these voluntary limits, the president's plan would offer federal vouchers for television ads and mailings. Those vouchers would be publicly financed, with money raised from ending the tax deduction corporations take for lobbying expenses. That's the aspect of the plan Republicans in the Senate will take aim at. The president tried to preempt their attack today.
This bill will be financed entirely by repealing the lobbyist tax deduction and voluntary contributions from the American people. No taxpayer who's paying anything now will pay any more to finance this bill. No expenditure now going to the education and welfare or national defense of this country will be diverted to pay for this bill. Not one red cent.
In addition, lobbyists would be prohibited from giving any money to lawmakers they lobby and from lobbying the members to whom they give money. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Russia's vice president said that he plans to run for president in 1966. Rob Parsons filed this report for the BBC.
Vice President Rutskoy had claimed that he had no desire to take part in new elections. His decision to change his mind, he said, had been prompted by President Yeltsin's television address on Thursday night, in which he accused Mr. Rutskoy of unprecedented disloyalty. The final parting of the ways, however, is unlikely to happen before new presidential elections. Mr. Rutskoy intends to stay on as vice president for as long as it's politically useful for him to do so. For the last year, he has skillfully exploited the fears of the millions of Russians bemused by the collapse of the Soviet Union and angered by the black marketeers getting rich while ordinary people have suffered. But the rift with President Yeltsin only became unbridgeable in the run-up to the referendum, when Mr. Rutskoy launched a scathing attack on corruption in high government circles. Now he has joined the growing list of candidates for the presidential elections.
Rob Parsons reporting from Moscow. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 5 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. In Germany, a 5-day strike by engineering and steel workers in the eastern part of the nation is spreading, and union leaders say that they will be joined by workers in the west sometime next week. Germany's largest trade union says that plans are underway to expand the strike over higher pay to all 5 eastern states. The workers are striking over broken promises to raise pay levels in eastern Germany to that of workers in the West by 1994. Under a 1991 agreement, wages in the East were to be raised by up to 26% beginning the 1st of April. The rate of unemployment in the United States did not budge in April, remaining at 7%. NPR's John Edstey reports.
The Labor Department's survey of households on which the unemployment rate is calculated actually showed the economy losing nearly 150,000 jobs in April. The number of people looking for work also fell, though, so the unemployment rate stayed the same. A separate survey of businesses was somewhat contradictory. It showed 119,000 non-farm payroll jobs being created, mostly in business services. Those gains offset a loss in manufacturing. The mixed report did little to clear up questions about the strength of the economy. A number of recent economic reports have given conflicting signals. Over the past year, the economy has created only about 100,000 jobs a month, less than half the pace of a normal recovery. I'm John Idstein in Washington.
Another fare war involving some U.S. airlines is underway. United, Delta, and American Airlines say that they will match fare cuts announced by Northwest yesterday on routes where they compete. Northwest has announced discounts of up to 30% on some of its airfares. Under the offer announced by Northwest, tickets must be bought by May 18th, and deeper discounts are available on air travel completed by June 30th. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, live from the Public Radio Conference in Washington, D.C. Our house band, led by Ben Vaughan. Some of the greatest soul and rhythm and blues recordings wouldn't have been made if it weren't for my guest, Jerry Wexler. Wexler was a partner in Atlantic Records from the early 50s through the mid-70s. His specialty was finding great singers and matching them with the right band and backup singers to create a sound that was both artistically true and commercially successful. The short list of people he's worked with includes the Drifters, Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, Bob Dylan, Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding, Eddie James, and Solomon Burke. Here's just a few of the records we have Jerry Wexler to thank for.
I've been loving you too long to stop now. See the girl with the diamond ring? She knows how to shake that thing. All right, now, now. Hey, hey. Hey, hey. I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour. That's when my love comes tumbling down. I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour. When there's no one else around.
Under the boardwalk.
Great stories about making this music in Jerry Wexler's new memoir. It's called Rhythm and the Blues, and it's just been published by Knopf. Jerry Wexler, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's great to be here, to plug my book.
I want to get started with your work with Aretha Franklin. I think that's a good place to start. Now, she had made about, 10 or so recordings on Columbia Records before coming to Atlantic. John Hammond produced her, and he was producing her like a jazz singer, kind of in the Dinah Washington tradition. Yeah. You, when she came to Atlantic, you worked with her. You heard something completely different. What did you hear when you started producing her?
Well, I heard the Aretha Franklin who sang in church, who sang Precious Lord when she was 13 years old. And a man in the audience was so overcome, he said, listen at her, listen at her. And I listened, and it wasn't so much that I tried a new approach to her. It's that what she did fit very well in with what we were doing anyhow.
Well, you sat her down at the piano.
Right.
You had her play herself, which I don't think she'd done on the records before that.
Not very much.
And then you took her down to Muscle Shoals, to Alabama, to the same place, actually, that Arthur Alexander started
exactly.
recording
in. I want you to know that I'm not one of the people who didn't pay him.
What was it like at Muscle Shoals? What did you hear there in that southern sound that you wanted?
Well, it was the way they recorded, which was ad-lib recording without written arrangements, building the song from the get-go, just from the chords, and the musicians made a fabulous contribution. So these were arrangements which we all did together. And they were just as much arrangements as anything that was ever done by Henry Mancini, in the sense of being an arranged piece of music.
So you took Aretha down to Muscle Shoals, recorded like a track and a half with her, and there was this really big fight. What was the fight about?
There was an explosion that went on because of too much Jack Daniels and not enough Prudence. And it had to do with Ted White, who was Aretha's husband at the time, who got it into a dangerous, over-friendly drinking from the same jug with a gentleman who can best be described as a card-carrying redneck, trumpet player. And it got into what we call the dozens, the Southern Dozens, and then it got nasty. And the session blew up, and we went back to New York with one song complete, which was I Never Loved a Man, and a three-piece track on the other side, which was Do Right Woman. And all we had there was rhythm guitar, bass, and drums, which is not a whole lot to go on.
Not even vocal?
No vocal, no piano, no background vocal. And then we finished by bringing Aretha and her sisters into the studio. And it was a pretty good piece of extemporization in that, starting with this very minimal track, Aretha laid down an organ part and a piano part. And then she sang the lead, and then she and her sisters got together and did the background. And it was a very full, finished record put together, I'd say, with spit and chewing gum.
You produced Respect. Is there a story behind how the Sakatumis landed on there?
Well, the story is that when Otis Redding did it, it was entirely a different song. The Sakatumis were Aretha Franklin's idea, where she injected into the song, which connoted a certain idea of social respect, probably the notion of ethnic respect, combined with a little judicious lubricity on her part. The respect that she was talking about was what you might call, very bluntly call, proper sexual attention. But it was her transmutation of Otis Redding's little Southern song. As a matter of fact, I was mixing the record in our studio on Broadway, and Otis walked in. He said, "That little gal done took my song." But he meant that in a very kindly way, because he saw the cash registers ringing.
My guest is Jerry Wexler, and he's written a new memoir. It's called Rhythm and the Blues. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what it means to me. R-E-S-P-E-C-T, take out T-C-T. Sakatumi, 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 ooh, hey. A little bit, little bit, just a little bit. I get tired, just a little bit. Keep on trying, just a little bit. You're running out of food, a little bit. And I ain't lying, just a little bit. Breathe, breathe,
Back with Jerry Wexler. His new book is called Rhythm and the Blues, and it's all about the people he's produced and a lot about the music industry behind the scenes. Now, your first studio was actually the office.
That's right.
Of Atlantic Records. Who did you? Because when Atlantic was young, you didn't have a studio. So what'd you do? You'd move out the chairs into the hallway whenever you wanted to record?
We did have a studio. It was our office, and it was a studio because we had equipment in it. And my partner, Ahmed Erdogan, and I shared this big room. We had two desks that were catty-cornered, canted toward each other. And what we would do is push them against the wall, stack them, and then our engineer, Tom Dowd, would set out camp chairs, a few microphones, and one mic in the hall for echo.
We're just going to adjust your mic a little bit there. There's so much that a record producer is up against, often the real unexpected, and I think a great example of that is when you were producing the Drifters' version of Under the Boardwalk. Let's start with the beginning of that story. First of all, they didn't want to even record the song.
That's right.
You gave them an ultimatum.
Right. I was not the line producer of that song. I was acting as a supervisor, you know, as an executive of the company, and the Drifters were always a concern of mine. And a great producer, deceased Burt Burns, was producing the record. and neither he nor any of the drifters could stand the song. They just couldn't buy it. And I didn't want to interfere because Bert was the producer, but this sounds like a very self-congratulatory. And I said, this song has to be done. And I said, you can pick all the rest. I said, or else ain't no session.
Why'd you like the song so much?
Because it sounded like a hit.
Okay, good enough reason. Okay, so what happened to the lead singer the night before the session?
The lead singer at the time was a man named Rudy Lewis. You know, we had three fantastic lead singers in the Drifters. The first was Clyde McFadder. The second was Rudy Lewis. His name is not as well known, but he did some great songs. And the third was Benny King, who's having a great resurgence with Stand By Me. I mean, you can't turn around without hearing it anymore. But Rudy Lewis, unfortunately, the night before the session, was found dead in the hotel room with a hypodermic needle in his arm. And the night before the session. And we tried to call off the session, but it was a big date, and we had hired a lot of union musicians, and the union wasn't cutting us any slack at all. They gave us 24 hours. So we moved the session ahead one more day, but then we couldn't even change the charts, so we had to use Johnny Moore to sing the lead, and without even the key change, and he managed to sing it in the key that was put to him. And the interesting thing about the record was we promoted it all along the Eastern Seaboard and Atlantic City and so on, and it evokes summer all the time.
And you actually did a lot of that yourself, didn't you? You packed up the car and drove around promoting the record because you wanted it to break so bad.
That's right, and we did a lot of that in those days.
Now, you work with Otis Redding a lot during his career.
I was not Otis's producer. I want you to realize that. Otis was produced at Stax Records in Memphis by that great team of Jim Stewart and Booker T and the MGs, especially Steve Cropper.
Now, you saw him change a lot as he became better known. What was he like in the beginning before he was very famous?
Otis was very simple, very unaffected, but he had the magic. And when he came to New York after his first hit record, I picked him up at the airport. No roadies, nobody, no nothing, just soul Otis. And he opened at the Apollo, and he just stood there, just straight on, with his arms at his side, didn't move. Another one who started like that was Marvin Gaye. But they learned some stagecraft, but what really kicked Otis into moving was having to follow Sam and Dave, who used to be described as a stage full of Jackie Wilsons.
That's really great. No, you know, we were talking before how you brought Aretha Franklin down to Muscle Shoals, Alabama. You brought Wilson Pickett down to Memphis to record.
Right.
You really loved that southern sound that was coming out of some of the bands there. Why'd you think of bringing him there?
Well, because everything was winding down in New York. I mean, it was entropy. We just couldn't get out of our own way. We had been very successful year after year. But our style of recording was a regular old-time standard style, using arrangers with written arrangements. Now, when you have to change an arrangement, and you almost always do, to accommodate the vicissitudes of the song and where you're going, it's total agony for the entrepreneur to see that clock going around while a man is going around with an eraser, erasing little notes on 13 charts. And this southern style of recording, where it's just all you have is chord indications. You go out, you sing a lick, do it like this, fellas. Bang, here's the new chord, you know. But maybe that's overstating it, but actually there's a spontaneity and a fantastic new element that comes in because the musicians are organic to the idea.
So you heard that
I heard the sound. I heard the sound, and I brought Pickett to Memphis, and we cut Midnight Hour and a lot of other things there, all in a hurry. It was great.
One of the great things about this book is that there's all kinds of like fights between legendary people that are out. There's a when you got the call that Aretha Franklin was ready to sign with Atlantic Records, there was a wonderful fight.
All right.
Happening in the studio between Wilson Pickett and was it Percy Sledge?
Percy Sledge. Percy Sledge is also a native of Muscle Shoals, like Arthur. He came from Alabama, and very genial, sweet man. And I was working on a vocal with Wilson Pickett, and Percy comes into the control room, And he said, "Wilson, that was great, man. You sound just like Otis." I mean, the red neck came up, you know, and Wilson bristled, and I got Percy out, and I said, "Percy, later." Well, he comes ambling back in about 3 hours later. He said, "Man, that was a hell of a lick. That was just like James." That's the worst thing he could have said, because James Brown and Wilson Pickett have had a century-old falling out about a chick, you know? And he couldn't have done worse. And Wilson went for Percy like that. I got in the way, and I probably went about 180 pounds, and he just flicked me like that, and I went to the wall. Because I used to call Wilson the Black Panther before there was a Black Panther movement, because he was, I mean, there was, the, to me, the ideal metaphor for Wilson, because he was sleek, he was beautiful, and he was like a baling wire and nuts and bolts, and he was terrific. Just a beautiful man, but a man who had definite ideas about his own whims.
So you got the call from Aretha in the middle of this fight,
in the middle
after
of that,
you were slammed against the wall?
Yeah, I bounced off okay, and I got a call from a woman named Louise Bishop, who is still, I think, pretty well known in Philadelphia, working under the name of Louise Williams, gospel disc jockey, a friend of mine. And in those days, Aretha's circle was the gospel wheel. That's right. Who she hung out with. This was before, you know, the big secular explosion. And Louise was a pal of hers, and Louise, a pal of mine, had sort of been hawking her on my account, and she said, "Here's the number, Aretha's ready." And like the fella said, you never look back, you know.
There's a lot more stories I want to hear, but we have to take a short break. My guest is Jerry Wexler, the great producer from Atlantic Records. He was a partner in Atlantic for about 3 decades. He's got a new book called Rhythm and the Blues. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel at All Things Considered. Coming up on today's program, we'll be hearing the latest news from Bosnia. The Muslim town of Zepa remains under siege by Serb forces who've refused to let UN observers in. I'll talk with Radovan Karadzic, leader of the Bosnian Serbs, about his statement that he's in favor of safe havens, although he says it's impossible to let the UN in to Zepa at this point. He also says that in the referendum campaign over the Vance Owen plan, he will remain neutral, although he initialed that plan in Athens. Also on today's program, Linda Wertheimer on a book of family recipes that African Americans have collected that maintain both family traditions and also family memories. That's next on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Back with Jerry Wexler. And Jerry, since our audience today is people from around the country, our colleagues in public radio here for the Public Radio Conference, I really want you to talk a little bit about the early days of getting black music played on white radio stations. And you were doing promotion as well as production at Atlantic Records back in the 50s and the early 60s when radio was still pretty segregated. And I'd like to hear a little bit about what it was like to get white DJs to play the rhythm and blues recordings that you were producing then.
Heavy agita. You just couldn't do it. I mean, you couldn't, except for white disc jockeys on black stations. This was an odd phenomenon. The leading disc jockeys on rhythm and blues stations were Caucasians who, without being mimetic, they managed to sound black, and the audiences accepted them as black. I'm talking about people like Zena Sears from New Jersey, Hunter Hancock from L.A., Huggy Boy from L.A., of course, Alan Freed, who came along and, of course, he got so big that he couldn't disguise his racial identity anymore. So it was very difficult. And this was not due to racist attitudes on the part of the PDs or the musical directors. It had to do with the advertisers. This black music did not fit with the demographics. It was simple as that. So it was no use ranting and raving. It was part of the socioeconomics of the era. The music, it would be like playing mazurkas, you know, on a classical station. It just didn't go.
Back in those days, too, to get a record played, you had to pay for it, more or less.
Oh, yeah.
To pay for consideration, as you put it.
Absolutely. It was a subterranean advertising, let's say. And these people were badly underpaid. Of course, I'm sure that hasn't. I'm sure that's changed a lot. And the guy, and the guy at the mic is just rolling in the fantastic emoluments.
So, what were some of the things you would do for the disc jockeys?
A nylon sweater, bottle of Jim Beam, until it got real competitive, and then we got into the hundreds per month.
Right.
Yeah. Another thing is that what you would do is that you'd bring your artist there, and he could have a stage show or a concert and be the entrepreneur, and he'd get them for a very low price, like zilch, sometimes nothing. And you paid your dues to get these records. And we were glad to do it.
You still producing?
Yeah.
I know you produced an Etta James record last year.
Right. And, I'd like to talk about it.
The Etta James record?
Yeah.
We're not going to have
time. I think it's one of the best things I ever did.
Yeah, really?
Yeah. And it was a Grammy nominee.
Uh-huh.
And it got lost in the shuffle, so it's going to be one of my Smithsonian entries.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us a little bit about your career and about making the music. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, and you all go back and sell my book wherever you go.
Jerry Wexler has been my guest. He's written a memoir about his years in the music business. It's called Rhythm and the Blues. Oh, I should ask you really quickly. You invented the term Rhythm and Blues.
Well, Casey Stengel says you could look it up. It's in the books.
Ah.
It was 1949 and 1950, and the term for that particular column was race records, and it was starting to sound pejorative.
Right, so you came up with a substitute.
Yeah. Right.
Great. Well, thank you very much for being with us, Jerry Wexler. And I also want to thank Arthur Alexander for performing for us earlier today, and I want to thank Ben Vaughn and his band, Ben Vaughn, Bobby J., Seth Baer, and Mike Vogelman, and I'm going to ask the band to play us out. Lots of people I'd like to thank for today's broadcast from the Public Radio Conference. I'd like to thank from WHYY, David Offmer, Nessa Foreman, Bob Prindable, Mark Vogelzang, and Chris Spurgeon, and a big thanks to Art Ellis. The Fresh Air staff is Dorothy Farabee, Danny Miller, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, Roberta Sharrock, Joan Tuohy, and Sue Weinstein. Our technical staff, Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, Jay Goldman, and Audrey Vablitis. Thanks to Lauren Kelly from National Public Radio. Thanks, everybody, for being in our studio audience, our public radio colleagues from around the country. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor John Turturro discusses his roles in Do the Right Thing, Miller's Crossing, and Barton Fink. Also, director Allison Anders talks with us about her movie Gas, Food, Lodging. It's out on video. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.